This is a CBC podcast. Enjoy Canada's opera, pop, jazz, and rock, all recorded live by CBC Radio. The Concerts On Demand website is your source for the best in Canadian concerts. Head to cbc.ca/radio2 and follow the link to Concerts On Demand.
From the Regent Theatre in Picton, Ontario, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. And I would like, in this week of weeks, on this day of days, when men and women gather, and their children too, at the cenotaphs and in the gymnasiums, in the classrooms and the office towers, and watch in silence as the stiff old soldiers are wheeled past, and the young ones too, marching by, their pipes and drums filled with the seriousness of purpose, the certainty of deeds. I would like, in this week, on this day, as we stand in silence and watch the parades and the wind-whipped flags, the snap of bugles and gunshots, the sudden flight of birds, the low gray sky, I would like, while we are speaking of remembrance, to say a few words about memory myself. It was an Australian journalist working in London who thought we should do this. He was, or so I'm told, distressed by the way men and women danced on Armistice Day. All the young boys kissing all the young girls right in the street. He wrote a letter to the Evening News. Wouldn't silence be more appropriate than dancing, he wrote. And so, 90 noisy years later, we stand, little pilgrims of sadness, separated from the dancing boys and girls by the years of regret. History, wrote Charles Warner, is nothing but regret. Though not the regret of war, it's clear, nor of the young soldiers face down in the mud, nor of the bewildered refugees, those orphans of war, with their ragged suitcases and their smudged eyes. Oh no, it's not war we regret. It's a regret even deeper than war, a regret that echoes in our memories like a piece of bone tossed down a well, the bone rattling off the stones all the way to the bottom, to where regret is waiting. We stand in our silence with regret by our side, and it is not the regret of war. It is the regret that everything might have turned out so differently. World War I was my grandfather's war. The armistice, which we remember this week, was signed in the darkness before dawn, 5:30 in the morning, in a railway car on a railway siding hidden in the French woods, as if peace was something you only spoke of at night, as if peace was something secret. The only story I know of my grandfather's war is the day when the war was over that he flew his little plane under London Bridge, which sounds like dancing girls and boys to me. World War II was my father's war, and though he fought in North Africa and New Guinea and Crete and Yugoslavia and was awarded the OBE when the war was over, he's not talking either. So at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, when I stand at the wall of regret in my silence, and the bugles play, and the old sad soldiers cross the stage, the memory that takes its solemn bow is not my memory. It is the memory of something I have never known. And when I try to look deep into the mirror of my mind and summon the memories up, for they must be there, locked in my DNA, son of soldiers that I am, a wisp of smoke, perhaps, the rattle of gunfire, the gunmetal sour taste of fear. When I try to touch the many, when I try to grasp all of it, or more of it, or even some of it, I always end up with none of it. Standing there by my sorry little self, knee-deep in the troubled waters of our troubled times, holding my little fishing net, which I have thrown out over the water so many times and pulled back just as many times, empty. For memory, as they say, is nothing but a net full of holes. I can tell you nothing about history, writ large or writ small. I know nothing about smoke and fire, heroes or cowards, the rains of Passchendaele, mustard gas, percussion bombs, whiz-bangs, the flare of a match, beginnings and endings. I have never known war, not my grandfather's, not my father's, not any of the wars we have fought or are still fighting today, God save us. But I can tell you this one sad thing. I can tell you the story of Private George Lawrence Price, a story I read in a book and have never forgotten. Private Price was the son of James and Annie Price of Port Williams, Nova Scotia, the sweetest little seaside village, I'm told, where the sun shines warm in summer and the wind blows the clean sea air over the dunes, a perfect place for a boy to kiss a girl. George was conscripted into the army when he was 24 years old. And who knows if he kissed a girl when he left for war? Who knows who was left walking the beach of memory waiting for him to return? He almost made it, safe and sound. But on the 11th of November in 1918, exactly 90 years ago this week, George, in Belgium, on patrol, advancing on the village of Havre, and when he and his friends crossed the Canal du Centre, they came under fire. There was someone or somebody shooting at them from a row of houses. They went into the house they thought the shooting was coming from, and they found the gunners, whoever they were, had gone out the back door. So they went into the next house and found the same thing. And it was when he stepped out of this house, the second house, that George Lawrence was shot in the chest. When the bullet crashed into him, it was 10:58 a.m., 2 minutes before the armistice that had been signed in that railway car that very morning took effect. George Lawrence of Port Williams, Nova Scotia, was the last soldier killed in World War I. He died with 2 minutes left in the game, in the war to end all wars. And George Lawrence is who I am going to remember this week. George Lawrence is who I have been thinking about while sitting alone in my house watching the television news, the windows shuttered, the doors locked, safe and sound against the darkness of the night, the wind, the rain, and the scraping and the sniffing and faraway yapping of the dogs of war, roaming still today as they roamed 90 years ago, snapping at the countryside of our minds. Here's to George Lawrence Price, 25 years old and 90 years dead, alone in his cold and silent grave in St. Symphorien. I remember. We remember. And as we stand for our 2 minutes of silence, we will remember you yet and beg your forgiveness. We have tried, but we haven't tried hard enough. We have been busy with other business, though I can't for the life of me remember what it was. We are sorry. Please forgive us. Have mercy upon our souls. This is my friend Jill Barber.
All faucets, where the wind blows and where the sea flows and the sun sets. But here we go on with the living and try to match the love we give with the love that we've been given. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust. We let go because we pass and nights continue to fall. Time moves ahead with it like nothing at all. But at some turn we reach the final page, whether we die too young or
Jill Barber. Jill will be back. But I'm back now. And a good thing, too, because it's time for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short stories. But after that, they don't have to be anything. It's up to you. We promise to read everything you send us, and we promise to read some of our favorites here on the radio. Today's story comes to us from Tyler Levine of Toronto, Ontario. Dear Stuart, writes Tyler, recently my fiancé Lindsay and I went on a vacation to France and took the opportunity to visit the beaches of Normandy. Our destination was the city of Dieppe and the Canadian World War II cemetery. Neither Lindsay nor I lost any family there. In fact, between the two of us, only Lindsay's grandfathers, Owen and Thomas, had fought in World War II, and they both made it through alive. We're fortunate, and we know it, which is part of why we felt compelled to visit the cemetery that day. We drove into the seaside town and towards the water, expecting the scene of the great military landing to be the logical location for the burial ground. And sure enough, as we reached the sea and parked the car and walked up to the rock-filled beaches, we spotted a Canadian flag. A lump formed in my throat. Here we are, I announced. Unfortunately, what we had found was a seaside casino with a set of international flags. Where is this world-famous cemetery, we wondered. Dieppe is a factory town, and we, an English-speaking couple from downtown Toronto, felt pretty intimidated as we tried to approach the people we saw. In our best and admittedly rusty French, we inquired about the whereabouts of the cemetery. Où est le cimetière des Canadiens? Much to our dismay, none of the locals seemed to know. They pointed away from the water. They said something about a nearby town. Back in the car, we drove around Dieppe for over 2 hours, growing increasingly frustrated with each dead end. Finally, in the middle of a roundabout, we spotted a small green sign which pointed us in the right direction. The sign pointed us out of the actual city of Dieppe into a farming community some miles away. And there, amongst fields filled with thick, fragrant poppies, was a small cemetery with a simple stone arch entrance. We parked at the end of a dead-end country road and walked inside. We were there alone, in front of row upon row of rectangular, ivory-white monuments, each as perfectly straight as the men who had once stood in formation. The grass had been trimmed no more than a few hours ago. The air smelled of moist greenery. It was like nothing I had ever experienced. At each grave, there was a flower, laid with military precision, yet with such sublime and fair grace, you'd think the invisible groundskeeper had spent time in art school. As we read the gravestones, Lindsay remarked about the large number of deceased who hailed from her hometown of Hamilton, and that most of the men were really just boys, and that most of the deaths took place over a 3-day period. There must be 1,000 young men buried there. My thoughts were abruptly interrupted by the sound of a woman yelling in French and honking a car horn. I walked back to the entrance to find a rugged, middle-aged local woman waving something in her hand. As it happens, I must have been so excited to finally find the cemetery that when I exited my car, I had dropped in the middle of the road my brown leather dossier containing both of our passports and all of our money. About 800 euros. The French woman was honking her horn so she could return my case. As the woman made a hasty retreat to her beat-up 20-year-old Peugeot, I called out, thank you, merci. She shook her head. She looked at me straight in the eye and she said, no, no, merci. She was pointing at me. It took me a moment to realize what she was trying to say. After she left, I examined the dossier and saw that the case had been opened. Not a penny was missing, nor a passport. But she had seen that we were Canadian. And although I'm sure that money would have solved a whole bunch of her problems, she had returned it. And so we discovered the people of Dieppe hadn't forgotten what the Canadians did so many years ago. They just chose simple gestures of kindness to express their gratitude. That story came to us from Tyler Levine of Toronto, Ontario. John Sheard's going to play the piano for you now. Thank you. That was John Sheard with a medley of two pieces, his composition, Vita Brevis, and the Navy Hymn for Those in Peril on the Sea by William Whiting. I'm Stuart McLean, and this is the Vinyl Cafe, and today on the show we're talking about Remembrance Day, or Veterans Day if you're listening in the United States. I told you at the beginning of the show that I have no memories of war. I've never been called to fight for my country. So I don't know much, if anything, about these matters. Although I'm sure of one thing, and that is, like all hard things, it's important to talk about it, to share our stories and memories, our ideas and our thoughts. My friend Chris Irwin told me a story recently, and I wanted to share it with you today. I want to share it because I found it moving. It's Chris's story, not mine, so I asked him to write it down. Here it is. "Dear Stuart," writes Chris, "thank you for asking me to share my story. It's not short. In fact, it's rather long, but it is true. So it's true to one of your two rules. It requires some background. I'll hurry in the beginning and slow when it matters most. My father's health has not been good, and because of that, travel is something that has become rare and difficult at best. Last year, however, my parents went to a school in Exeter, Ontario, to hear a presentation given by students returning from a 2-week trip to Europe. They had followed the history of Canada's war efforts from France through Belgium and up into Holland. It moved them. The man organizing it concluded the evening saying that he had had such a great response, he would lead another tour for anyone who would like to take the same journey. Normandy, Juno Beach, Dieppe, Etah, Beaumont-Amel, Vimy, the Somme, Flanders, Ypres. Names that are not so much destinations as they are signposts of Canada's military history. Not names at all. Events. Having given up on travel to some degree and international travel completely, my parents did something unlikely. They signed up on the spot. My father had sadly accepted that he would never get to the place where his father fought and his uncle died. To be offered the chance in his 70s was too much to resist, even with his health. Desire replaced regret. And so my family heard of this bucket list pilgrimage and cautiously cheered. My mother let it be known how much it would mean if our whole family could go with them, but time, responsibilities, money, and work prevented it. Only my sister signed on, in part to give her 12-year-old son a taste of history, and more specifically, to see to it that my parents had the help they would need to pull it off. In the weeks leading up to their departure, my brother and I admitted to each other how it bothered us to be sitting this one out. How could we? But how could we not? Somehow the questions were answered. We decided on a 4-day plan that would see us join them en route and accompany them at least until Vimy. We'd make it a surprise. Why not? And that way, if it fell through, none would be the wiser. Okay, selfishly, it was for us to follow that historic path, to pay respect, to be on those beaches with our father as he experienced them for the first time. But it was for our parents, too. To express our gratitude for raising us with an awareness of the past. They always insisted that we remember. We could let them know we'd not forget. They had, after all, signed us up to play in a pipe band when we were both young. Dad played. He had, I think, been hopeful we would meet history firsthand in the Ingersoll pipe band. There were many veterans in the IPB in those days, living proof, much loved. And somewhere in that place between appreciation and recollection, It came to me. If we went, if the pieces fell into place, I would take my pipes and play at Vimy. For my parents, to honor them, to let them see I understood their lessons in life, to honor the fallen as well. And so it was. Just days out, the plan took shape. My brother and I packed light and picked a flight. We left. Pieces of my uniform stuffed into my bag, my pipes jammed into the smallest case I could find to be sure the airline would let me and us carry on. The surprise went well, a reunion of emotion and tears. We let Dad in on it late in the game for fear a shock was not what he needed most. He loved being in the know. It gave him pleasure to see the thing unfold. But the pipes remained my mystery. At one point near Dieppe, my sister said the words my grandmother had said each time I visited. "You didn't by chance bring your pipes, did you?" When my grandmother asked, she always knew the answer, of course. But my sister did not, that is, did not until my pause gave me away. She spoke first, "Mom's dying to ask, but knows you likely couldn't." For 2 days, nothing was said. We immersed ourselves in Canada's past. On the eve of our stop at Vimy, we came along the coast, south out of Etah, south to a cemetery that fell away from the road to the right, not visible to the channel, but away in that direction. It was another spectacular example of how the Commonwealth War Graves Commission continues to do such remarkable work. We had made several such stops at similar cemeteries. So many there are. But this one hit me uniquely. The lateness of the day, perhaps. The shadows, long and perfect on the precisely cut lawns. The strong, solid marble monument you enter through, high on the hill, massive and still. Or the 11,000 headstones you look out and down upon as you come through the gate. 11,000. Something rose in me and said, "Right here, this is where you'll play." So quick, back to the car, uniform on, tune up out by the road where the traffic will muffle a sound. The first I'll be heard is as I rise over the steps by the stone of remembrance. I opened my pipe box. I took them out and stared into the now empty box lined with 50-year-old velvet. It should have had a small bottle containing 2 reeds. It didn't. I was angry. Disbelieving, most of all embarrassed, standing there in a kilt in France at the side of the road without any way to play. Pipes need reeds. I put everything hastily away and took the long walk down through the row upon row of stones and shadows to where my sister and brother were looking at the names on some German headstones in the back left corner. The dead, of course, all made the same sacrifice. And in many cemeteries now, men from both sides of the line share the same soil. That walk brought perspective. My disappointment felt selfish among the staggering number of names on the stones around me. And while shocked at forgetting my reeds, it was only a wish, not a life, that was lost. I was humbled, not angry. I told my brother and sister, admitted it hurt, and left it at that. They said little save, "Sorry." At supper that night in Arras, France, my mother could finally not keep her curiosity contained. She started the main course with a question. "You didn't bring your pipes with you, did you?" During the meal, I told Mom and Dad of my plan and my problem. We tried to make light of it. We spent dessert wondering the ways one might find a reed overnight in Arras. It was a short conversation. We thought of none. We went to bed. The next morning, my mother came to breakfast with two ideas. The first, to call a local tourist bureau about an upcoming festival. She had a pamphlet. Perhaps they have a pipe band coming. Who knows? Her second idea redefined long shot. So much so that my mother told only my sister, who, as a last resort, handed me a piece of paper. Carol McPherson, it said. Below the name was a number. My sister explained, it's the only Scottish name in the Yarra phone book. Call her. I didn't. For an hour. But when my sister asked again and then offered to call herself before we left the hotel to begin our day's tour of Beaumont Hamel and then Vimy, I said, no, I will. The voice that answered the phone was French, without the trace of a Gaelic brogue. Je suis Canadien, I said. Parlez-vous anglais? With that, I was out of French. But apparently not luck. The phone was passed to someone who asked me in English to whom he was speaking. My name is Chris, I said. I am Canadian. I play the bagpipes. I wanted to play today at Vimy, but I have no reed. I wondered if you know of any place I might be able to get a reed. I spoke slowly in case he was working in a second language. Fast or slow, I knew it sounded crazy. I expected him to hang up. He didn't. Do I have a bagpipe reed? He said. Just the way he said it indicated he had said those words before. Most people would not so casually have said bagpipe reed in context. I felt a glimmer of optimism. Cautious optimism. Yes, I said, the chanter reed. For small pipes, he asked. No, I said, I play the Highland pipes. So you need a cane reed, not plastic. Afraid to ask another question, I waited. I cannot help you, he said. But I know someone you should call. His name is Pierre. Pierre Alexis Cambiron. He makes bagpipes. He might be able to help you. A bagpipe maker? Where does he live, I asked, fearing that timing might still be an obstacle. Our stop at Vimy was only hours away. He lives here in town. Try the number. See if you can find him. I said thank you a few too many times. Just before hanging up, I thought to ask his name. He was Chris Craig of Arras, France. I don't know if he lived with, was married to, or even knew a Carol McPherson. I didn't think to ask. Right or wrong number, hope glimmered. I made my second phone call. Pierre Alexis Cambiron answered. He spoke English as well. The conversation began with much confusion. But eventually he said that he may have a reed that would work in my pipes, a cane reed at home. He was at work, a teacher. He could check at lunch. I should meet him at a school across from the pharmacy at the end of the long road you are on once you've walked through the train station tunnel. Go under the tracks, through the main door. It's not to be missed. That was how he put it. I hung up the phone, not quite believing where this was heading. My brother Bill and I told no one. We said we were going to head into town at noon to see if any music stores existed. We said we would catch up with the tour as they left for Vimy. As our family walked the Regina Trench, we took a deep breath and walked away from our car, parked in the busy square in front of the train station. People in movies do this, my brother said, not people like us. It was just as Pierre had said it would be. We waited by the gates of a school, and within minutes we were following a perfect stranger up the steps of an empty school and into an empty classroom. He held a small tackle box under his arm. I held a pipe box under mine. I only had to see the reed to know that it would do the trick. How it would sound was not the point. that it existed was enough. I played for him briefly. We smiled at each other. "You don't know how much this means to me," I said. "What can I do to repay you?" He shook his head. It was left that just helping another piper was reward enough. "If you're ever in Canada and need something," I joked. But as I left with his reed, I realized that this might be a debt that would remain unpaid. We met the tour and made our way to Vimy. Only my brother and I knew how things had taken shape in the hours over lunch. I wasn't sure how to begin. In our brief conversation, Mr. Craig had warned that playing at the monument might be tough. That was his word, tough. "It is an overwhelming sight," he said, "a very public place to play." So I began as pipers do. Bagpipes need to be tuned. One needs a private place to do that. Not wanting to warm up near the people at the statue itself, I drove down a side lane. There were two cemeteries down the road and a small looping path between them. It was removed, surrounded by grain fields to the south. It was discreet. There were three or four people walking among the white stones in the walled cemetery nearby, but no one else. Would playing intrude, I wondered? Cautiously, I began to tune, then to play. After 15 minutes, I turned around and any uncertainty I had of the effect fell away. The people in the cemetery were walking toward me together. I spoke first, hoping to establish a tone. "I'm sorry if I interrupted you," I said. "I needed a place to warm up. I hope it didn't disturb you." The woman told me that her father used to play. Then, through tears, she said that she had not heard the pipes in a long time. The others were not with her, but followed her over to me, wanting, it seems, to thank me for playing and to ask my story. I told them briefly what I have written to this point. And with handshakes and smiles, we went on our way. They to their cars, me to the monument on Vimy Ridge. I didn't just walk up those great steps and begin. I went down the hill and started in the distance below, slowly moving toward the base from the north, unsure, respectfully. I was met with smiles from those that passed by. I was also met by my brother, who, when I asked if I was attracting the wrong kind of attention up at the monument, said he thought not. "They would like you to come closer," he said. "I think everyone up there would agree." I played for an hour or more that afternoon. Slow airs, waltzes, laments. And when three wreaths were laid in commemoration by my parents' tour, I offered to play Flowers of the Forest, the lament you hear after the laying of wreaths almost everywhere you go on Remembrance Day. There were less than 50 people there to hear my pipes that day at Vimy Ridge, but among them were my parents. And because of that, I played for the entire world, my entire world, and for the lost lives for which that monument stands, the many, many lives. Bagpipes are nothing without a reed, and a piper is nothing without his pipes. That day, as moving as it was, would not have been the same. I can't say it would have been nothing. Anyone who has ever stood in the shadow of that proud monument will attest to that. But for me, well, I will return and I will play again at the base of those towers of remembrance. But my parents will not be back there. I'm sure of that. My family will not drop everything to join them on a tour to remember the fallen in France. I know that too. And I believe I will never find a more fitting way to honor my parents and the love and support that is a lifetime's work. To play for them in that moment, on that hill, on that day, was perfect. I will not forget that day. And now I know what it is. It is a gift to me and to my children. I have a picture of my family united in a small cemetery. I have two stones, one from Dieppe, the other from Juno Beach, my reminder that I stood with my father while he stood there with his, both feeling, though not saying much. I have a real poppy, and I saw them blow and growing wild still, much more delicate than those we wear. And I have a reed, which I plan to return to Pierre-Alexis Cambrian when I return to France with my children to teach them my parents' lessons and in turn give them their gift, to let them see the rows of lives that lie there, lost, to let them touch with their own hands the stones that times made smooth, to let them hear bagpipes played upon the ridge, maybe even to play along. But most of all, to be sure they experience the sigh of silence that follows the pipe tune's end. And when they do, I hope that my children will wonder in that most quiet moment what it must have been like. What it is that brings people across the world to walk respectfully among the names, for names are all that remains. What emotion it is that puts that look upon each face and brings so many to tears. That quiet is real. It is peace. And what we feel must be remembrance. That comes from Chris Irwin of Burlington, Ontario. And Chris is here today. And yes, to answer his grandmother's unspoken question, he brought his pipes. That is him you hear now warming up. Chris is going to play for us, and he's going to play the lament he played that afternoon on Vimy Ridge. This is Chris Irwin playing The Flowers of the Forest.
Thank you.
That was Chris Irwin. And he was playing with the reed that he got in France. We have time for one last song before we say goodbye today. And we're going to get Jill Barber back out here to sing it. Jill's going to sing a song written at the end of the First World War by two Canadians, Jean Lockhart and Ernest Seitz. This is Jill Barber with "The World Is Waiting for the Sunrise."
The world is waiting for the sunrise. Every rose is covered with dew. And while the world is waiting for the sunrise, and my heart is calling.
That's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank the musicians on stage with me today, Dennis Pendrith on bass, John Sheard on piano, and our special musical guest, Jill Barber. Thanks today to Frank Finistori, Bill Herald, and Brad Scrutton for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Ron Skinner's the recording engineer. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner's the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and we're going to let Jill Barber sing us home now. So long for now.
Dear one, the world is waiting for the sunrise. Every rose is covered with dew. And while the world is waiting for the sunrise, and my heart is calling. The world is waiting for the sunrise. Every rose is covered with dew. And while the world is waiting for the sunrise, and my heart is calling.
Barber and Chris Irwin.
Stuart McLean and the Vinyl Cafe will be taking their annual Christmas concert on the road in December, making stops in places like Sarnia, Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Ogdensburg, New York, Ottawa, and Massey Hall in Toronto. You can check the website to find out if they're coming to your town, vinylcafe.com.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.